Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, The Professional Voter. Benjamin Franklin once said, "When the people find they can vote themselves money, that will herald the end of the republic." When someone gets paid to do something, they are a professional. My observation is that you already know we have a few generations of society that court the influence of politicians who will make sure a check shows up every month in the proper amount. The thing I want to make clear is how we got here, and that there's a way out of this era of dependency. It goes both ways, you know. We have an entire political party. We still have a two-party system, you know, that would evaporate into the history books if the process of buying and selling votes was removed. Roosevelt's New Deal was praised and criticized by politicians, economic experts, and businesses during the 1930s and still is today. They were extraordinary times, to be sure. Now we need to talk a little bit about why the stock market crashed in 1929 in some detail. Suffice it to say that there were two major recessions and then a build-up to a massive stock market fueled by 90% margins. That's buying stock with a margin account with the low risk that the market would go up and not down, and the hype of promoters. The middle class was quickly forming and even making the transition to upper class, based not on earnings of the public companies, but on the difference between the purchase price and selling price of their stock certificates. The banks were in on it as well. After all, they had the deposits of their clients with which to gamble. The stage was mostly set by highly leveraged investment positions, extremely high unemployment, and highly inflated stock prices. Keep in mind that all trades were done on the floor of the exchange. There were no computers programming micro trades several times a day to stack small returns into large quarterly returns. There was no Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation making sure the deposit was safe up to $100,000. There was nothing like that. The crash of 1929 built up slowly and meticulously, as though it was designed from scratch. America was not alone in this. In its 14 years following the Great War up to 1933, the Weimar Republic was functional and seemed to be making progress at establishing a democratic government. As it turned out, it was not the government that was the problem. There were natural forces in society that are well known from millennia of experience. There were representatives in the Republic who were considered extremists. They battled for supremacy from the pulpit and in the alleyways of the city with knives and guns. The crafters of the treaty knew full well what they were doing. This post-war haggling by financiers and politicians fixed German reparations from World War I at an annual fee of 132 billion gold marks. This was about one quarter of Germany's total 1921 exports. To no one's surprise, Germany could not make the payments. Germany was forced to use its coal and steel industries to pay the debt. When they defaulted on the payments to the banks, French and Belgian troops moved in and seized the coal mines and factories. The people responded passively by refusing to work hard, and Germany was forced to print money to pay its debts, causing runaway inflation of over 1,500%. The victors of World War I tried twice to restructure Germany's reparations payments through the Dawes Plan and the Young Plan. The financial burden of reparations was carefully designed and utilized by the international bankers for their own benefit. This was one of the main sources of German discontent that led to acceptance of Hitlerism. The Dawes Plan and later the Young Plan were designed to provide huge amounts of cash that money traders could use in the United States. The micro trading of cash has long been used by traders to build capital without risk. This capital was utilized in the mid-1920s to create and consolidate the gigantic chemical and steel combinations of IG Farben and Vereinigte Stahlwerk, respectively. Both plans were engineered by these central bankers, who managed the U.S. government committees that managed the reparation plans. The Dawes plan arranged a series of foreign loans totaling $800 million, with their proceeds flowing to Germany. These cartels not only helped Hitler to power in 1933, they also produced the bulk of key German war materials used in World War II. Even though Germany is technologically the strongest nation in Europe, it did not repay the reparations from the Great War until October 3rd, 2010. The banks made clear an unearned profits from the financing charges. The industrialists and governments received billions every year in cash or valuable commodities for more than 90 years from the Treaty of Versailles. One more thing. These industrialists and bankers were forming a military-industrial complex, the exact wording of General and President Eisenhower, intent on making money from manufacturing and selling weapons to both sides of the war. Not just one war, but all wars, everywhere in the world, were the focus of these men. Peace would forever be financially impossible. The greatest and most powerful military machine in history was built in less than 5 years, and was at least 5 years ahead of anything on Earth. When the first test of the Blitzkrieg and Luftwaffe occurred against the Basque town of Guernica on April 26, 1937, by the invitation of Franco, the U.S. military was flying old radial engine technology. There were no trenches, there were no battle lines. There was only a massive mechanized unit utilizing highly advanced technology, including night-flying, radar-guided aircraft. The raid was over in roughly 2 days. Tactics included terror bombing and strafing of civilian targets to break the will of the enemy. It was successful in Guernica, and it was successful in Rotterdam in May of 1940, where Holland surrendered in just 6 days. War would never be the same. While banks and industrialists were making huge profits, the American economy was about to collapse. The stock market had weathered 2 crippling recessions and come back to record price performance. Trading cash and stocks, not on the prospect of earnings, but on the speculated price of the paper itself, was driving the perception of value. The perception there was the perception was there only for the middle class that was pumping everything they had into the market, chasing the perception of value, leveraged the public and the smaller banks to the point that if anything happened to end the Ponzi scheme, they would collapse. The perception did not negatively affect the upper class and industrialists. On the contrary, it cleared the table of all competitors and allowed them to buy up entire industries for pennies on the dollar. The crash was designed. The crash was necessary. The crash only needed to be triggered, like some economic Higgs event, to make the black hole of money explode and create a new universe. When the crash was triggered, it took place in a matter of days. When the final act occurred, the stock market crashed so hard and so wide that the middle class completely evaporated. By the time the dust settled, there were 2 classes of Americans. There were billionaires, and there were people working for 25 cents a day and all the potatoes they could carry home. Within a few days, the middle class went broke. The broke became the poor. The poor became the desperate, and then angry, and then hopeless. America was a nation with no hope, because the very foundation of capitalism had been shattered to the ground. People needed a hand up. The wealthy became the theme of Gatsby and Rockefellers and grand industrialists who bought up city blocks and skyscrapers for pennies on the dollar. Oh yeah, I almost forgot to mention. They paid cash. Cash? Who had cash? Exactly my point. The people who had cash had it because they got out of the market at the peak. They didn't deposit their money in the small banks. They had their own banks. They had real cash coming into their economic powerhouses by financing a war machine that the people in the U.S. didn't know about or care about. They had their own steamships to travel to make their to their own banks and to get cash to buy up America. While the people and the government scraped garbage cans for lunch, the military-industrial corporations walked like the gods across the globe, sweeping all opposition out of their way. President Hoover was an engineer who made a small fortune in mining. He had no former elected office, but he won by a landslide in 1928 against his Democrat opponent, Al Smith. Hoover was a former cabinet member, an insider, who knew government was wasteful and would prosper from partnerships with large economic powerhouses. He supported the presence of powerful industrial financiers, Dawes and Young, inside the congressional and senatorial committees to gain access to the faith and credit of the federal government. This gave insider trading a new function and has never been expunged from Congress to this day. Within 8 months of his 1928 election, Hoover watched America stolen out from underneath the Republic by a global economic body so powerful that Congress was powerless to stop it. Everything worked exactly as planned, except for one thing. America now had an inconvenient society. The former middle class had no jobs. They had no money in the bank. They owned no property, and they needed food. They needed medical care and educations, and they had lost their dignity. The nation did not need management. It needed leadership. The presidential election of Franklin D. Roosevelt was overwhelming in 1932. He won his election in New York as governor in 1930. The catchphrase, "It's the economy, stupid," would have been famous during the campaign. The name Roosevelt was well known, and Americans were eager for change and for relief. There was another reason why the election went for Roosevelt than the feeling of the people. President Herbert Hoover blamed his 1932 defeat on the withdrawal of support by Wall Street and the switch of Wall Street finance and influence to Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was right. But why would Wall Street shifted support away from a man who paved the way for business to enter the committees in Congress? Why would Wall Street withdraw its support from the one man who, either by design or through skillful handling of an inexperienced politician, allowed cash to rain from heaven into the unaudited pockets of the Federal Reserve and the financial cronies of Dawes and Young? Well, I'm glad you asked that question. The banks and power brokers were not satisfied with owning the country of Germany for the next 90 years. They wanted to own the United States of America as well. They wanted to have a steady flow of virtually unlimited cash from the American taxpayer. And they wanted to form a new class of society that was dependent upon giving them everything they wanted in exchange for a small check each month. The election of 1932 began an era that would establish the very America that Franklin, Jefferson, and the rest of the Founding Fathers feared the most, the creation of the American professional voter class had begun. Roosevelt's New Deal had programs that seemed to flow from a pre-designed box of ready-made solutions. His cabinet created more than a dozen new agencies, most of which are now universally known by their acronyms. Government agencies love acronyms. These agencies are more powerful than government itself. In fact, it can effectively be argued that the professional voter class has funded a new government, the real government, while our legislative and judicial branches of government sit idly by and act like temporary employees, unhappy and powerless to do anything about it. One more thing needed to be done to make sure that no success could penetrate or hinder their control over the economy. The money traders needed to keep their cash engine in order to control the global economy. So the president unilaterally enacted the abandonment of gold standard in 1933. His appointee to the Federal Reserve controls the money supply to the public, while being able to write virtually unlimited blank checks to the bureaucracy he alone controls. The private ownership of gold was outlawed. Cash was allowed to float to a new value set by the government through what would eventually become the Federal Reserve we know today, a group of private banks in Europe, formed with the glut of wealth that was tucked into their vaults by the profits of war. Most people do not realize the extent to which the Democrats bought the votes of hundreds of millions of citizens over more than a century of graft and subterfuge. The sad pictures and film strips showing the downtrodden were used in a national and elaborate propaganda program to convince voters to make the federal government the employer and sole benefactor for an entire generation of people. This is a short list of the new agencies that were created. Reconstruction Finance Corporation, a Hoover agency expanded under Jesse Holman Jones to make large loans to big business. That ended in 1954. Federal Emergency Relief Administration, a Hoover program, to create unskilled jobs for relief, replaced by the WPA in 1935. Some WPA programs included adult education. Civilian Conservation Corps, also known as the CCC, from 1933 to 1942, employed young men to perform unskilled work in rural areas under United States Army supervision. Homeowners Loan Corporation helped people keep their homes. The government bought properties from the bank, allowing people to pay the government instead of the banks in installments they could afford, keeping people in their homes and banks afloat. Tennessee Valley Authority in 1933, effort to modernize the very poor region, mostly of Tennessee, centered on dams and generated electricity on the Tennessee River. It still exists today. The Agricultural Adjustment Act, 1933, raised farm prices by cutting total farm output of major crops and livestock. It was replaced by the new AAA because the Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional. National Industrial Recovery Act, 1933. Industries set up codes to reduce unfair competition, raise wages and prices. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional. Public Works Administration, 1933. It built large public works projects, used private contractors. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation insures bank deposits and supervises state banks. It still exists today. The Glass-Steagall Act regulates investment banking. It was repealed in 1999. Securities Act of 1933 created the Securities and Exchange Commission. Codified standards for sale and purchase of stock required awareness of investments to be accurately disclosed. It still exists. Civil Works Administration. It provided temporary jobs to millions of unemployed. Indian Reorganization Act moved away from assimilation. Social Security Act, 1935, provided financial assistance to elderly handicapped paid for by employee and employer payroll contributions. It required 7 years contributions, so the first payouts were in 1942. It still exists. The National Labor Relations Act, in 1935, set up National Labor Relations Board to supervise labor management relations. The Judicial Reorganization Bill, 1937, gave the president power to appoint a new Supreme Court judge for every judge 70 years or older. It failed to pass Congress, by the way. Federal Crop Insurance Corporation, 1938, insures crops and livestock against loss of production or revenue. It was restructured during the creation of Risk Management Agency in 1996, but it still continues to exist. Surplus Commodities Program, 1936, gives away food to the poor. It still exists as the Food Stamp Program and has expanded by 70% in the last 3 years. Fair Labor Standards Act, 1938, established a maximum normal work week of 44 hours and a minimum wage of 40 cents per hour and outlawed most forms of child labor. Still exists. Hours have been lowered to 40 over the years. The Rural Electrification Administration, also known as the REA, one of the federal executive departments of the United States government charged with providing public utilities, electricity, telephone, water, sewer, to rural areas in the U.S. via public-private ownership. It still exists today. The Resettlement Administration resettled poor tenant farmers, replaced by the Farm Security Administration in 1935. Within 5 years, the middle class had their needs seen to in whole or in part by the federal government. The nation went back to work in record time. Many people make the argument that regions of America would not have seen benefits like electricity, roads, education, and health care for decades. The truth will never be known, because it's impossible to recreate the same situation and try it again. Many economists believe that America would have pulled out of the mire left by the military-industrial complex of World War II on its own through free market action. The value of the economy was there. The earning capacity of America was still there. There is an even larger and more compelling argument that the formation of a dependent class, rather than a middle class, was paramount for the success of the military-industrial complex. While America was a landscape in which middle-class business was rendered unable to deliver its historic and innovative abilities to pull out of the ditch with free market forces, the need for soldiers and nurses and military factory workers superseded everything else. A new class of Americans had been created in less than 5 years. While wars rage on around the globe, the middle class was stripped of its ability to succeed and supplied with everything its citizens needed in exchange for one thing, their vote. As long as Democrats were elected, the checks would keep coming to countless mailboxes across the nation and around the globe. As long as the campaign funds kept coming into the Democrat election machine, the agencies would continue to collect taxes and fees and launder money through to those corporations who make those contributions. It has become a multi-trillion dollar war machine. A professional voter class had become very effectively indoctrinated, bought and paid for with a federal stipend. They were perpetually emasculated from ever being successful. It has been made famous by so many politicians over the last 60 years that even if a blue dog ran for office, if it was a Democrat, it had a loyal vote. To this very day, anyone who refuses to follow orders from Democrat leadership is publicly excoriated and financially ruined. If they should happen to prosper anyway, government agencies like the IRS have been and are currently employed to financially destroy them. As of the writing of this book, the IRS is being ordered by the Senate to investigate the Tea Party Political Action Committee. The Internal Revenue Service is caught in an election year struggle between Democratic lawmakers pressing for a crackdown on nonprofit political groups and conservative organizations accusing the tax agency of conducting a politically charged witch hunt. The pushback is likely to be just as fierce. Jay Sekulow, a conservative lawyer known for his stands on religious freedom than for his tax work, said he is representing 16 Tea Party groups that are claiming harassment by the IRS, and the number is growing. He said he intended to demand an explanation from the Treasury Department on Wednesday for what he calls McCarthyism tactics, and that he would contact Republican lawmakers this week. This is obviously a coordinated effort by the IRS to stifle these Tea Party and Tea Party-affiliated groups and to stifle free speech activities, Mr. Sekulow said. It's as onerous as what they did to the NAACP in the 1950s, and I plan to make that point. The style and volume of the interrogatories are designed to make it impossible and or extremely expensive for that organization to continue its political campaign support. The creation of the dependent class from the once vibrant middle class is vital to the perpetuation of the economic and political support for the military-industrial complex. There are two more things that I need to discuss in this book about the military-industrial complex. You're not going to like them, but they are as true as light itself. My skills as a master statistician always get to the root cause of any problem. This one is not hard to derive, but it is heartbreaking nonetheless.